So, here we are again, investigating the Lin Ji Lu. Still at it. I want to read two short passages tonight, because they're speaking to me. Venerable monks, in the three realms there is nothing secure. These realms are like a house on fire. They are not the place to make your lifelong home. At every moment, impermanence, like a demon, is there to put out its hand and take your life, making no distinction between the young and the old, the noble and the lowly. And then later on we read, only because emotional attachment arises, understanding is obstructed. Because perceptions are changing, the form of the true nature changes. That is why there is rebirth in the three realms, and we have to undergo so many kinds of suffering. According to my way of seeing, there is nothing that is not deep and wonderful. There is nothing that is not liberated. I'm investigating impermanence, and I'm investigating emotional attachment, and I'm investigating them from a place where I really don't want to be. One of the dearest friends that I've ever had in my life has dementia. It's a fast-moving form of dementia. And what I am sitting with is all of the heartbreak of watching my friend lose his mind. Impermanence. And of course, what I'm sitting with is my attachment, my sense that this cannot be. No, can't happen. My friend's name is George, and George and I have been friends for 30 years. We're also colleagues. George is about 6'6". He towers over me. He's got a big shock of unruly white hair. And my constant image of him is leaning over to listen and to really inquire of whoever he's with. And he shines that attention so beautifully. And we have had this connection for so many years, professional, personal, family. And he's one of those people who I cannot imagine being in the world without. He's the person who I discuss every major life change with. He's the person who will tell me when I'm chickening out, when he thinks I'm hiding from something, when I need to step up. He's the person who was thrilled when I went to my first Zen sitting. And when I came back from my first Sesshin and I was so eager to tell everybody about my first Sesshin experience, you know what that's like. And of course, after you've let out about two sentences, most people's eyes glaze over and they just want to get away as soon as they can. George wanted to know. He wanted to know everything. What's it like to sit that long? What does your mind do? What is this thing about realization? What happens when your knees hurt? How is it different from what we do in psychotherapy? He really wanted to know. And we shared so much. We shared our work. We still do. And every week for 20 years, we taught a class together, a seminar, for young psychiatry residents. We taught them psychotherapy. We taught them basically the art of listening to the heart, of listening to what people aren't able to express with their words, of listening between the lines, and then reaching deep inside to find some responses that might, just might, relieve some suffering. So, every Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock, I'd be there with our 16 residents, eager, and George would kind of shuffle in 10 minutes late, and he'd have papers flying, and he'd, his clothes would be in disarray. He reminds me a lot of our teacher, James Ford, in that way. You know, kind of shambling and shuffling, and to the casual eye, you would think there isn't much going on. And I used to play this game. My game was, what has George had for breakfast? Because George liked muffins, and invariably there would be some blueberry hanging from his beard or some piece of whole wheat muffin stuck to his tie. And we role-played, and we teased each other, and he dubbed us Click and Clack, the brothers from Car Talk. We would do our shtick. And with a kind of playfulness, help people learn to listen as people open their hearts in our offices. And the most amazing thing for me for 20 years was to listen as someone would talk about a person they were working with in psychotherapy, and after just a few moments of description, George would zoom in and be able to touch on the person's deepest concerns, deepest fears, cut through all the details and the minutiae and the history and just get right to the heart of the matter. He has been, for me, the closest thing to an embodied Avalokiteshvara. He can hear the cries of the world better than anybody I know. But there's impermanence. Dogen tells us, flowers fall even though we love them. Weeds appear even though we dislike them. Weeds are growing in George's brain. And of course, because he's so shambling and shuffling and self-deprecating and laughs at himself, it took much longer than it might have for us to realize that the mistakes were more frequent, that the misunderstandings were bigger, that he was no longer able to keep together all the details of tending to a psychotherapy practice. And it was on the day he told me that now, when he looked at the clock to see when a session was supposed to end, he no longer understood what the numbers mean, that I had to sit down with him and say, George, it's time to end your practice. So a month ago, I helped my friend stop doing the thing that he loves to do the most in the world. So I sit there with impermanence and when Linji says, at every moment, impermanence like a demon is there to put out your hand and take your life, making no distinction between the young and old, the noble and the lowly. demon it is. And so I sit and I rail. I sit on my cushion here and rail at the demon of impermanence. And then my hell realm lifts and the bell rings and we walk together. And I remember this beautiful Sangha. And impermanence, like an angel, takes me out of my hell realm. And of course, that's what we live for. The moment the bell rings and the knee pain stops, those self-releasing states that we're so glad to see end. Impermanence is simply what it is. It's not a demon. It's not an angel. It's the most reliable thing we come to know as we practice. So the solution is just not to be attached, right? Isn't that what Linji's saying? Only because emotional attachment arises, understanding is obstructed. Maybe if I just say the five remembrances enough times, I'll get inoculated against the pain of loss. Sometimes I say them and think, oh, I really have to remember this. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change. And if I just say it enough, I won't have to feel the hurt. And I used to have this image when the readings, when the teachings would tell us to give up those fond attachments. My thought was, well, that's what it's supposed to be, right? We're supposed to get to a point where we don't prefer anything. We're not passionate about anything. Is that what Linji's telling us? I don't think so. Every sentence of this excerpt of Linji was written by a man of great passions. He was passionate about the Dharma. He was passionate about his students waking up. He had great love for Zen. He's not telling us that the problem is our attachment and our love for the things that we care about and the people that we care about. He's telling us that the attachment is to ideas, to these fixed views that the mind forms at every turn, to try to freeze reality, to try to stop impermanence, to try to put a clear plastic coating over the luminousness of everything that is. I didn't get this. I was just sitting on my cushion feeling the injustice of it all and feeling very sorry for myself as well as George. And then I got the most unexpected teaching. Our Sangha mate, Leah, who was here for a few days and who left yesterday, when Leah was describing her work with developmentally disabled adults, with people who were severely demented, she said, you know, in the beginning of our lives, later in our lives, and sometimes other points in our lives, our needs are simple. All we need is to be warm and fed and cared for. And then somehow it gets all complicated. But what she conveyed was her joy in being able to connect with people around warmth and shelter and caring. And the great genuine pleasure she took in it. And suddenly my head was turned around. I realized that I had been holding on to a very rigid, fixed view of George and his illness. Dementia, nothing but bad, nothing but lack, nothing but what's he losing today? How much is my friend not here today? Making me completely lose sight of the dinner we had the night before I came to this sesshin, where we laughed and joked and teased each other. And he was so present some of the time. And even when he wasn't present, he was just his wonderful self. And what Leah helped me to see was that when I put aside my rigid idea of what dementia is and what was happening, I realized that I've become more intimate with George in some ways because of his illness, and that I will become intimate with George in new ways that I can't yet imagine. As I connect with him around those basic needs for care and safety, so now I sit with my heartbreak. And my outrage and my sadness. But now there are moments where there is a space that opens up around those. They're still there, but there is this space. And what fills that space is love. And in those moments, I know that Linji was right. We don't have to go searching for the transcendent. The transcendent seeks us out. So, sit comfortably. And now we have our Dharma dialogue. Or not.
Thank you for sharing the story. Very appreciated. When you were talking in regards to these ideas that form around these things, I just went to like my own experiences, and it's so, I guess, vital, it seems, in those situations where the ideas are so fixed, to have someone else, to have someone with some kind of like unbiased perspective that can shed light on the situation, like Leo was able to do. And I just think that, that compassion, that meeting people where they are, seems like a pretty poignant part of being able to like be there with someone, especially in these situations where there are these diseases that are out of our control.
And what you're saying about how sometimes we're lost in our fixed ideas and we need someone else to just to take us out of it somehow, to reflect something back, to offer something that just turns us around a little bit. I don't know how we do it without Sangha. I really don't know.
Baba, appreciated your talking about your process, and how you turn toward this, you know, terrible loss that you're feeling now, and so honest about your feelings of anger and sadness, and being willing to sit with that and stay with it. And then there was, you know, this sort of gift, right, from Leah, or it could have been from anywhere, where this, the compassionate voice of Kuan Yin entered into that dark place where you were, and through no effort on your own, just appeared, and you were able to entirely transform, you know, what had been this real hell realm that you were in suddenly opens up into this so much more spacious and place that now is like, I don't know what it's going to be like, you know, like you're feeling very, your tenderness toward it, and just so the way you described it was so beautifully how we turn toward and then we just wait and receive, right? Yeah, it's, yeah. So vividly you described this. Thank you.
You know, sometimes we talk about how the universe meets us, the universe supports us, and sometimes I think, nah, it doesn't really. And then there are these moments where, you know, the transcendent does seek us out. It came and got me. And as you're saying, it could have come in many, many forms. It happened to be Leah, but it could come in so many ways. It's coming every moment. If I get rid of my rigid map and can just see.
Well, and don't you think, you know, that there's a readiness on your part through the practice of Zen, you know, that this vulnerability that happens when we sit like this makes you ready? Because I think the transcendent is always coming towards us.
Yes.
And most of the time we don't notice it because we're lost in our fixed views. But then there's a ripe, you know, that vulnerability is a ripeness and an openness. And so you can receive it. And that's a big part of this practice.
Yes.
Is recognizing it when it shows up and then receiving it.
Yeah. You know, in that vulnerability, I was thinking about, you know, my image of the real person of Zen who doesn't, you know, who's not fazed by anything, heart never breaks. And I realized that that's just the opposite of what's happened to me over the course of practice. If anything, my heart is more tender. It's more easily broken. It's out there more. And that's when I realized, no, that's not what Linji's saying at all. He's a man of tremendous heart.
I loved how you talked about it. He's so passionate.
Yeah.
Everything we read about him, he's just so passionate.
Yeah.
And passion is part of being compassionate. Yeah. You know, that great opening of the heart.
Yeah. Ray.
I loved your story. Except I had some difficulty at the end with seeing the transcendent as some resolve to this struggle that you were having, and because transcendent as people are saying is there even without resolve, and the wanting some resolve to the pain of, you know, to the struggle, to the anger. And if I sit long enough, it'll become clear to me. That's a misconception that it doesn't necessarily come clear. Or it comes clear for a moment, for this. And then it could get lost. And then you're back into the anger and resentfulness and you know, that sense of loss. And maybe this time with some greater openness to seeing the transcendent in the confusion in the grief and that. And so that's what, you know, the grace of the Sangha, I guess, is getting a glimpse and then losing it, you know, and then being able to be a morbid to see it in the confusion and loss.
Oh, that's so beautifully said. And, you know, this is not a happily ever after thing I just said, right? That, like, I'm really, I mean, this is not not going away, right? And so you're right. And sometimes I lose it completely and I'm just lost in the mud, in the yuck of what I feel. So you're absolutely right that it's... And then try to just be with that and be with all that is that I don't want it to be, and be with the not wanting it to be that way. You're right. It doesn't resolve. It doesn't come out all right in the end.
It makes me think, it's such an important point you're making, Ray, and clarification of what I think you were intending to say, which is really important. And what kept coming up in my mind as you were talking was the difference between resolve and dissolve, you know, like a resolution is done, but a dissolution is kind of a melting away. Mm. And there is some kind of wearing off. You know, in great pain and distress, as you say, we have these moments of transcendence that we might miss. They fly by so fast in the middle of all this because things are, our old views are dissolving. But we would love for finality. Like, yeah. I'm cool with it. Yeah. You know, whatever, dementia. Yeah, no
yeah,
big
great.
Deal. But it's hard. It continues to be heartbreaking. That's the thing. And some of those fixed views are dissolving away. And that allows us some moments, as you said, and then, because it keeps getting, unfortunately, it does get worse.
It doesn't get better.
No,
you know, that what if it never gets better? Yeah.
This what is, if it never gets better?
This is it.
This is it. This is it.
Susan, did you have your hand up?
Moments with her like this in the previous few months and all the years before.
Yeah.
And you might have said it, I'm not sure. But so this is my attachment to about my view about my mom. Very often I have the feeling that I'm suffering more than she is suffering. And as well, here sitting in the seshi for 2 weeks and not knowing what will be when I'm going back.
Yeah. You know, Susan, what's so beautiful in what you're saying is that you find yourself open to these possibilities that you probably didn't expect. You probably wouldn't have known that you were going to have more intimate moments with your mother now in this phase of your relationship. That's where not knowing is so amazing.
And whether we think we know or not, we are surprised.
Yeah.
Right? Reality has a way of cutting through our fixed ideas of how it should be and how we should be, and so important, I think, to cultivate as best we can, meeting each situation. You know, what is this meeting? Finding the transcendent, or being in the middle of the pain and the confusion and the anger, as well as being there when it all drops away. And there's some possibility of two hearts that know each other and can dance together in ways they never allowed themselves. You know, this self-consciousness drops away, and none of our stories fit, and the great blessing of the heartbreak is this possibility of something so precious that's never been missing, but maybe never so directly touched.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing. So let's sit for another few breaths and then we'll walk.